New series today, and I was pretty excited about this series because it's different than what we've been on. You know, we were in that Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People series, and it gets a little depressing at times. I thought, well, let's do something different. So we're coming up on Passover. It's not that far away. And as some of you who've been through our Passover before know, there are four cups of Passover. And these are gifts that God gives us. They're almost like phases of the Christian life and the Christian experience. Now, we will see it through the lens of the Israelites coming out of Egypt, but it has application beyond just that. And so today's cup, the first cup, is a cup of sanctification. Now, I think I've said this before, but every Monday, or sometimes my family doesn't wait till Monday, sometimes it's Sunday, Stas and Victoria come up to me and say, what's this week's sermon on? Which always puts pressure on me because that means I have to know a week in advance, and sometimes I don't. But so this week I was ready for them because I knew I've been planning this series now for a couple of weeks. I said, well, this is going to be on the first cup of Passover, which is the cup of sanctification. And Stas looks at me and picks up a pen and goes, spell that? Sanctification, essay, what's that? And so I spell it for him, and he says, can you use that in a sentence for me? You know, I was like, what is this, the SAT test? And I couldn't. You know, it's funny because I'm like, well, Pastor Grice is preaching on sanctification this week. Is that a sentence that accepts? Because it really means to be set apart, but, you know, there's not a whole lot more I can say than that. In a quick thing, obviously the sermon is going to be longer than that, but you know, what exactly can we say about it? Well, if we look at the fact that this is like four different phases of life that we go through living with God, then this is the first phase, and we're going to take a look at that, but it literally means, the word sanctified means to set apart. And the first cup that is that we will drink in the Passover feast will be based on a verse in Exodus, Exodus 6:6, where he says this, say therefore to the sons of Israel, this is God talking to Moses, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of Egyptians. I will bring you out. And I will bring you out for the purpose of sanctifying, because now we're going to be set apart, because that's literally what the word sanctification means. It means to be set apart. And that becomes a little bit of a problem, because people say, well, what does that mean? To be set apart, you know. So, okay, we're off of sanctification, but what does it mean to be set apart? Does it mean we're better than anybody else, you know, because God called us out? Are we better? And what does that mean to the other people who weren't called out? And so, rather than going down that rabbit hole, I want to talk about something I think people can understand. And I'm going to go a little bit away from scriptures. I'll be back. Some of you don't panic. We will get back to the scriptures. But I'm going to talk about sanctification in a way that made sense to me. Anyway, I hope it makes sense to you. Does anybody know what this is? Anybody? Okay. A couple of people last night did, actually. I have one of them here. This is what's known as a Franklin planner. Kids, this is paper, and we use these things called pens to write in it. You know, so those of you who are used to iPads, you can't turn the pages like this in them. It's a little different than maybe what you're used to. But this is a Franklin planner, and you know, back when I was in a different life, I was in something called, I was a sales engineer. So I've always been a technical geek, but I worked in a sales department, and I actually reported to a salesman, although he was called sales manager, and we worked together. And that was the first time I ever saw a Franklin planner. And in fact, it was used against me as a weapon, and that's how I realized the power of the Franklin. So what happened was we were in these meetings, and the guy I worked for at the time, he was kind of this type A personality. He was an like ex-athlete. Well, baseball player, but you know, athlete, but he was a big guy. He really was big, strong guy. He was like 6'4" or something. He was like block chin, always dressed immaculately. You know, very driven, very forcefully talked. You know, could be pretty intimidating. But so we were in a meeting in his office, kind of going over what's going on, and I'm just sitting there, and he's got his little Franklin there, and he said, "Did you call?" And he named the company. I said, "No." He said, "Well, I told you yesterday to call him, and you said you would." I said, "No, that never happened." He said, "Yeah, it did." And he picked up his Franklin. He says, "See right here, it says," and he has their name. You know, he says, "See how I have an arrow there? That means I delegated it to you. And see over here where I have that arrow and I have your name, Grice? That means that you're to call them." I said, but you didn't have that open when we were talking yesterday. He said, no, I wrote it down after you left. I thought, well, you know, you could have written anything down. You know, it's like, that's not proof. But what I found out was it was more proof than I had, because I had this vague recollection. I never said that. And he had my name written down on a piece of paper. And I learned quickly that the guy at the planner wins, you know, in that kind of a debate. And so I realized I'm going to have to take care of that. In fact, as I was walking out the door, he said, you need to get yourself a Franklin planner. And I thought, yeah, I need to get something. You know, I'm not going to have many more of these meetings. He can say whatever he wants. I'm going to write his name down on some stuff, you know. And so the next time we were out on a sales call in Denver, we stopped off in the Galleria Mall at the Franklin store, because that's where they used to be. I don't even know if they existed. Franklin exists, but I don't know if they're still the stores, because they had a whole store to buy this stuff, because back then everybody was on paper. It wasn't weird. Anyway, so we walked in, but I'm a techie, right? And so I'm looking around the store, and I see this book that's called something like Understanding the Franklin Planner. I'm like, whoa, this thing comes with a manual. I'm all over that. I'm a techie. So I pick up the manual, and he says, what are you doing? He says, you don't need that. I'll tell you what to write. Just buy a planner. I said, no, I'm going to read the manual. Oh, it drove him nuts, you know, you technical people. So I went home, and I read the book on the Franklin Planner. And first of all, I found out that it was named after Benjamin Franklin, which was cool because I always kind of admired him. But then I also realized that it wasn't used for what I thought it was being used for. See, it wasn't used to track what you do. It was actually designed to track what's important. And it's not the same thing. And in fact, my boss, Mike Harper, wasn't even using it right. He was just using it as a to-do list in a book. But it wasn't designed that way. It was actually set up in order to help you do what's important to you in life. And I got so fascinated by it, I actually asked the company if I could attend their seminar, which is really expensive. But they said yes, because if you work for a big company and you say, I want to manage my time better, they always have to say yes to that. And you know, I could take it. My company's weird. They said, take the next available, whatever you have. So I looked on their schedule, and they had one in Pittsburgh. And I was living in Texas at the time. I thought, oh, this is cool. So I came home, you know, visited friends and family, went to the Franklin Planner class. But I would say that it is the number one thing that I've ever attended outside of anything having to do with the Bible, that impacted my life. It was really a great day. It was fun, and it was motivating. It was inspirational. And so the guy came into the room, and I was sitting there with, you know, 60 people just like Mike Harper. You know, they're all these type A sales guys. That's who was there, right? And everybody's kind of looking at their watch and, you know, checking their messages and things. And so this guy comes in. He knows he kind of has to grab the crowd quickly. He was very good. And he says, hey, how many of you think it's important to read? You know, and everybody's like, hands. And these kind of meetings, I don't know if you've ever been in them, but if like 70% of the hands go up, 100% will go up because they don't want anybody else to think they're not, right? So it's like, oh yeah, me too. That's the way these guys are. So we all raise our hand. We all think reading's important. He said, I don't just mean like reading papers and reports and stuff. How many of you think like reading a book's important? Well, that was a challenge and none of us were backing down. So all of us kept our hands up. Well, yeah, books are important, you know. He said, okay, well, how many of you have read a book this past month that you didn't have to for work? And like everybody's hand went down, except like three of us. And the only reason mine was up is I had flown there, so I read a book on the plane. So I look at you guys, okay. And so then he asked this question. He says, so if everybody thinks it's important to read a book, and in 1 month's time, none of you did read a book, why do you think that is? And in the back of the room, somebody said something that I think is one of the most profound things I've ever heard in one of these meetings. He says, the book doesn't ring. And in fact, the instructor liked that so much, he went and wrote it down to use it in his next class. He said, that's perfectly expressed. A book doesn't ring. A book's not urgent. It may be important to you, but it's not urgent. He says, what rings? Well, a telephone. Okay. How many calls do you guys get a day? And this was, you know, this was like after email had started, but before texting started. So most of the business was done on a phone. And everybody, you know, 30, 40 phone calls a day, these guys. He says, what percentage of those would you think are important? Honestly, after you get off the phone, you thought, well, that was an important call. And he went around the room, it was like 5%, 10%. And he said, well, look at that. Because a phone call is urgent, you are doing it instead of what is important, even though you know 80 to 90% of those calls are wasting your time. Why is it that we're willing to do what is urgent instead of what is important? And so as we kind of looked around ourselves, like, yeah, what's up with that? He says, what's important to us gets put aside for what's urgent to us. And then there came the killer on this. He said, so let me ask you another question. Who decided to call you? You know, that's a weird question, right? He said, no, why did they decide to call you? And everybody's kind of stumped on that. He said, well, I'll tell you why, because it was important to them. Which means your urgency is being decided by somebody else's importance, and you're doing what they want. Now, boy, you tell a room full of type A guys that, and you've got their attention. Like, hey, I got to stop this. You know, this cannot continue. And so the whole thing was basically saying what we need to do is we need to take the time out to first understand what's important in our lives, and we need to make sure that what's important to us ends up on our planner so it's just as urgent to us as the other stuff, and we have to start understanding when we have to, put other things aside, even though it seems like we have to do it. So let me ask you a question that they asked us, and I would say that he was 100% true, because everybody's like nodding their heads by this time. I mean, he had us, by the way. He had us good. We all stayed attention for the rest of the seminar. He said, how many of you have ever worked really hard for a whole day, and you went to bed at night, and as you plopped into bed, exhausted from working, you thought to yourself, man, I didn't get anything done today. Ever had that happen? Like just last week, probably? I mean, I have it happen all the time. He said, let me tell you why that's happening. Because you spent your time doing what's urgent to you instead of what's important to you. And there's some part of you inside, which I would call your soul, that's saying you didn't do anything that mattered today. You were so caught up in what was urgent, you forgot what was important. And so this is the thing. You know, we all get the same amount of minutes in a day, about, you know, we all get the same number of days, but we have to understand that what we do with it matters, and we kind of conceptually know that, but what is important to us? And the thing that was really amazing to me is that this happened. Like, I had to adopt Franklin. I became a better Franklin user than my boss. In fact, we had a couple more planner-to-planner meetings, and he stopped bringing his after a while, you know, because, I mean, I took to this. Now, it's not in my nature to take to this, but I knew my survival in this company depended upon it. So, you know, I made it my nature. Like, my wife, she could, like, probably take this thing for a week and teach the class because she's got the nature for this. You know, she loves this. I actually, after a few years, I got away from it. This is newly bought, though. I'm getting back into it because I realized I'd stopped doing what I knew worked. Because during this period of time, not only was I, you know, I have this job and all this responsibilities, but I was also going through my first divorce. And I knew, you know, it was a very painful decision, but when I made that decision, I moved a mile away from where Emily was living with her mother, and I knew I wasn't going to see Emily as much as I used to, because we used to see each other every day. And I actually made a lot of sacrifices to get as much time as I could. As a guy, that's very hard to do. You have to give up stuff to get your kids' time. It's the way it works. So I gave up a lot of money in order to get Emily 50% of the time, but I also knew that was 50% less time than we used to spend together. And so I knew that every day that I had her, I needed to make count. And so the way that Franklin works is you come up with these different categories, A, B, C, D, where A is your most important. And then after you do all that, you number those, A1, A2, A3. So every day that I knew I'd have Emily, I put her, first thing in my planner, A1, and I just put her name, Emily. So I knew that she was on my planner. And then the next morning when I woke up and I was kind of setting up my day, I'd pick a time on my day, and I'd write her name into that time. So I actually designate a time where I would just take this block of time, and we would do whatever she wanted. And that's what I would tell her. We're going to do whatever you want, and your parents will probably sympathize with me. Usually it was watching a movie we'd seen 50 times already. Thank God Frozen wasn't out there. I don't know if I would have made it. But, you know, but we went through them, you know, Beauty and the Beast, and we had all the Disney DVDs. And we went through them. And sometimes, you know, she'd want to go out to eat, or sometimes we'd go to a pool or whatever. And it would vary then, depending on what, you know, time of the day. Sometimes it'd be morning, sometimes afternoon, sometimes evening. But I always make sure that I had an hour at least designated to her every day where we would do something. There's nothing special about that hour, right? 3 o'clock, who cares? 3 o'clock's nothing. But as soon as I put her name on it, it was set apart. And all of a sudden, that became the most important hour of the day, because I knew the most important thing in my day was going to fill that hour. Do you see what set apart means? Set apart means I'm going to take something which may be completely ordinary, and I'm going to make something extraordinary out of it, because I'm going to set it apart for a special purpose, and that's what this is all about. Every day of every year is blank. It only becomes special because of what we do with it. what are you doing with it? Are you letting things urgent crowd away your time? Because I'm pretty sure if I asked everybody, and I won't do this to you, I promise, hey, how many of you think God's important? I'm sure we're in church, man. Everybody's going to raise their hands, right? You got to, just so no one else, right? In fact, I could even go further. I could say, how many of you would say God is the most important thing in your life? Well, again, we're Christians. We know the answer to that question. Yeah. How many of you set aside an hour a day to be with the most important person in your life? I wonder how many of us could honestly keep our hand up. In fact, I could go further. How many of you are setting aside an hour a week? Now, I know you're all here, so you did that today. Do you do it every week? I mean, do we set aside time for the most important thing in our life? Now, the reason I got this is because I've gotten very bad at it. I used to be aces at it. I used to be great at it. And I tried, you know, because when technology, I'm a nerd, so when technology came out, I tried phones, I tried tablets, I tried everything. Nothing worked. I finally told Victoria, I said, you know what, I'm drowning here. I got two jobs plus a church. I got a family. I got a house that still needs fixed. I'm drowning here. I'm going to go back to paper and pencil because I knew that worked. And we stopped off on the way to a business trip, and I picked up my Franklin Planner pages and I refilled it because I know this works. If I'm diligent, I know it'll work because I've done a very bad job of putting my family first and putting them on my planner. Things which are urgent end up taking over our day. How much time are we setting aside for the most important things in our life, including and especially the living God? Now, we're going to talk next week about the second cup, which is bondage, you know, breaking the bondage and delivering us. And usually when we get to that cup, people think in terms of addictions. And there's no question that's a bondage. That is really a bondage. You know, I know people in this church who are struggling with addiction problems, you know, whether that be alcohol, whether that be drugs or pornography. There's a lot of addictions that can grab you. And when it grabs you, that becomes the most important thing in your life. Ask any addict, they'll tell you. You know, an alcoholic is always thinking about his next drink. And even when they're not by the drink, they're thinking about it. You know, and if somebody's having an affair, they're thinking about their next time they get to see that person. You know, if they're with their wife, they're not thinking about that. They're thinking about the next time they're going to be with their lover. Whatever it is, if it's an addiction, we all know that takes over your life. Drugs do it. Everything. It changes everything about you. We know that. So it's really easy for me to preach to the addicts about bondage and being released from bondage because they want release from bondage. You know what's hard? What's hard is when I'm talking to people who are really letting other people set their agenda and don't think there's anything wrong with it. But that's bondage too. You're letting people who don't know God tell you what to do with your day. Now, I understand that some of us work for a living. You may work for, you know, Godzilla with a shave and he doesn't believe in God. I get that. But we do it a lot. We do it places we don't need to. I mean, I see it every week. I see parents making the choice to let a soccer coach determine whether they go to church. Because if the soccer coach schedules their kids for practice, that's where they are. Or hockey, or t-ball, or a number of things. Somebody not involved in your life is telling you this is now important to you, and you're buying it. And I see it all the time. In fact, you know, we talked about Roberta a lot, you know, this person we lost last year. Shortly after she started coming to Spirit Chapel, in fact, right after we dedicated their kids, she came up to me one day and said, Pastor, I don't want you to think I'm mad at you or anything, but we won't be here for a few months. I said, okay, what's going on? Says, well, Reagan's in T-ball, and he's you know, on a team that, believe it or not, everything they have is scheduled to either 10 or 10:30 Sunday morning. So, you know, we just won't be here. I said, well, we'll miss you. But we never did miss them because they never left. You know, after a few weeks of this go by, you know, I pulled her aside and said, hey, don't get this the wrong way. I'm not trying to kick you out of the church. But didn't you say you were going to leave? You know, by now, you're still here. She says, you know what? I decided to put him in a different league. You know, he wanted to be in that league because his friends were there. But I decided you can make new friends. I'm not missing church. See, she was not going to let somebody else's importance determine what was urgent to her. She made a decision. It's a hard decision to make because sometimes you don't have another league to go to. Sometimes you have to make the choice to say, no, I'm not going to do that. And it's very difficult because I get it. You know, I'm a parent, and so I understand. If you take your kids to everything they do and you're running yourself exhausted and you're talking to your friends about it, they'll tell you what? Boy, you're a good dad. Boy, you're a good mom. Boy, you're the best. You know, all the stuff you do for your kids, you're so good. If you told me I pulled them out of all that stuff to make sure they go to church, no one would tell you that, would they? No one would say, oh, you're such a good parent. You're depriving your kids of all this fun so they go to church. But here's the thing that's just killing me. I don't know if I'm going to bust any bubbles here, but your kids aren't going to play professional soccer. They're just not. I mean, I know some people who are very, very good at soccer, some of the EF's finest, and they play recreational soccer today. They never turn pro. You know, you're probably not shuttling Sidney Crosby around to the games. It's probably not going to happen. You know, so it won't matter 10 years from now if they can bend it like Beckham. It's not going to matter 10 years from now if they can hit a slap shot 90 miles an hour. But you know what I can guarantee you your kids are going to run into? Porn. Promise you. I also promise you that if you've got a daughter, she's going to be pressured to start sleeping with her boyfriend in high school, maybe even middle school. Promise you that's going to happen. If they get married, I promise you they will face divorce. I'm not saying they're going to get divorced, but one out of every two does, so I can promise you they'll face it. I can promise you they'll face addictions, peer pressure, job pressure. You guys know what that's like. And we are raising a generation that don't know how to turn to God for those things. So we're teaching them how to bend it like Beckham. But we're not teaching how to take it to Jesus like David. And that's not being a good parent. I'm just going to say it. And we have to say what's important to us, and we have to start deciding that goes in our planner. And whatever system you use, you know, if you don't all go out and buy Franklin. I'm not selling Franklin. I'm just simply saying we have to decide what's important to us and not let other people decide that for us if we're ever going to get to where we need to be with Heavenly Father. And Jesus says this himself. He says, look, don't worry about what we're going to eat or what we're going to drink, what we're going to wear for clothing. Look, pagans, they go after that kind of stuff. Your Heavenly Father knows you need it. You need to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. And don't worry, because everything else is going to get added onto it. Here's the plan, me first, he says. And I'll take care of the rest. Your kids will be fine. They'll get over it. You'll be fine. You'll get over it. Me first. We have to go me first. God is calling us out of the land in which we live. He's saying, I want to bring you out. I want to set you apart. And I want to come and be with you in a very special way. Now, I grew up like some of you my age. My impression of Moses was Cecil B. DeMille's movie, The Ten Commandments. My Moses was always Charlton Heston, you know. And if somebody were to ask me, what does Moses say to Pharaoh when he first sees him? I would tell them, you know, because man, that's etched in my mind. He goes walking into that marble floor and pounds that staff, you know, and let my people go. Do you know Moses doesn't actually say that, by the way? It's actually not in the Bible. Here's what happens when God's talking to Moses. He says, go gather the elders of Israel together. So don't go to Pharaoh, go to the elders, and tell them the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what's been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt. Well, that sounds pretty good. And he says this, and they will pay heed to you, that's the elders, and they will go with you, the elders will go to the king of Egypt, and you'll say to him this, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now, please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may worship the Lord our God. He wasn't asking to leave. He's asking for a three-day pass. He's asking for a weekend. Hey, can we have the weekend off? Go worship our God. They were shocked, by the way, when Pharaoh said no, because they'd done this before. If you read the account, many years before this, when Joseph's father died, they all got up, the entire nation, and went and buried him back in their homelands and then came back to Egypt. They'd done this before. The reason God told them this is because he needed them to know that they were caught in bondage, because they wouldn't believe him if he told them. He says affliction here, later he'll call it bondage. See, right now they think, well, that's a little bit hard here, but you know, we're free to go. No, they weren't. And it wasn't until they went there and Pharaoh said, yeah, that's not going to happen. Get back to work. That they realized, we're trapped. And at that moment, God could actually start talking to them honestly. You're in bondage. Hey, look, there are a lot of us who are trapped and don't know it. Do you have control of your schedule? Can you get up and go worship God for 3 days? Probably not. And so a lot of us are trapped and we're stuck in bondage right now and we don't even know. It's really hard to get delivered from a bondage you don't know you're in. Very, very difficult. So do you hear God calling you away from the world? I say, well, that's Old Testament. Yeah, he does it in the New Testament too. Jesus did this all the time. We know that he called the 12 disciples. You know, we know all that story. But did you know he called other people too? In fact, it's I love this. This is like all one scene in Luke. He's just finished preaching. He starts going around. He turns to this one man. He says, I want you to follow me. Okay? And then he says, Lord, okay, fine. But let me go first and bury my father. My father is dead. I need to go bury him. Now, this is amazing to me. Picture this. This guy's with Jesus. He's probably been with him all day, 2 days. Where's his dad? He doesn't know. All, it doesn't matter to him. Then all of a sudden, you know what? I have to go take care of this first. If he goes, he's not coming back. Jesus knows that. And Jesus says this to him. He says, let the dead bury the dead. You said your father's dead? He's being buried by more people who are dead because none of them know me. But watch what he tells them. You go and preach the kingdom of God. Jesus is seeing somebody who apparently has this great gift of preaching. He sees something in this guy. He says, you could preach for me. You could tell people the stuff I'm saying. You could go do that. Man, imagine that. There's an honor. You know, I wish Jesus come to me and tell me that. You know, I need you to go preach for me. Whoa, man, can you imagine? He says, well, I got other stuff to do first. And you kind of get an idea when that happens, Jesus is kind of looking around and people are like getting nervous. One guy says, Lord, I'll go with you. But first, let me go and bid them farewell at my house. I have guests there, Lord, and I want to be a good host. So let me go say goodbye to them. What kind of host is he? He's not there. You know, he's not even there. He said, well, let me go talk to these guests of mine. I'll be right back, I promise. He can trust me. I'll be right back. And then I'll follow you when I'm all done taking care of all this. And Jesus says this, no one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of heaven. In other words, if you're getting ready to do the work I'm putting before you and you turn around and think twice, you're not fit for the work I've put before you. Here's the scary thing about Jesus, by the way. He never chases anybody. He'll go out of his way to meet with somebody, but when he stands before him and says, follow me, and they say no, he turns around and walks away. He never chases anybody. You know, if we're kind of waiting for Jesus to chase us, it's going to be a long wait. Okay, many just can't seem to pull away from the world. Just can't. And we see this. Now here's the dangerous thing. God is calling you away from the world. He is. He's calling you right now. Come away. Come away. And a lot of us are giving them dumb excuses why they just can't do that. Just can't. You know, my family, my friends. That's what this was. My family, my friends. He says, nope, I'm calling you. Here's what happens if we say no. I just want you to catch this. Because we want to be with God, and we want to have this relationship with God. We want to be Christians, but we don't want to leave the world. We want to stay right where we are. Can't you just save me where I am? I want to be saved here, please. And that'd be good. I could do a lot of good for you here. Just let me stay here. And Jesus said, no, come here. I'm going to sanctify. You need to come to me. He says, I'm not going to really do that. Let me show you a scripture that shows up in Revelation. And it actually shows up other places too. But it kind of answers some of the questions we were dealing with in the last series. He cried out with a mighty voice saying, Babylon is fallen. Now don't get caught up in Babylon. Babylon symbolizes the great cities of the day. Just pick a great city and stick it in there. Pittsburgh if you want. You know. He says this, because she has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit. He's talking about the world today, by the way. And a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. I love that. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. That's very gently put if you look at what the Greek actually says. It says what you think it does there. Okay? And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. There's a lot of people who've become very rich selling the sensuality of the earth. And we know that. We see them everywhere. Okay? But watch what he says. I heard another voice from heaven says, come out, my people. Come away from her. Come away so that you will not participate in her sins. Stop it. Stop living like the world. Come away. But watch what this says. And if you do, you will receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. What he's saying here is, if you're going to be in the world, when the plagues fall on the world, you are going to get them too. And this is all the way through the Old Testament, by the way. And Jesus talks about it again. This idea that you're supposed to be away from the world because plagues are coming. We talked last week and kind of, you know, because it was a point of contention for some people that rain falls on the just and the unjust. And boy, that's not fair, is it? You know, we work so hard and the unjust get the rain too. Listen, the rain does fall on the just and unjust, but the plagues were never meant to. The plagues were never meant to fall on God's people. In fact, every plague that falls in Egypt doesn't hit Israel, because even in Egypt, they're not with them. They have their own place they live. So when hail falls from heaven, it doesn't hit them. And when the frogs pop up and destroy everything, it doesn't hit them. Everything, because they weren't there. But we've mingled. We're indistinguishable now from the world. Do you know the divorce is just as high inside the church as outside the church? Same statistics. Here's one for you. Internet pornography addiction is the same inside the church as it is outside the church. We are mingling with Babylon, and the plagues are falling on us that were never meant to. We have to come away. And Paul, he talks about this. He says, look, let us hold fast the confessions of our hope without wavering, for he who promised them is faithful. That's Jesus. Let's consider how to encourage one another, to love one another in doing good deeds. And I love this next part. Not forsaking our gathering together in assembly, as some are doing. I wish I could just take that and give to everybody who says they don't need to go to church anymore because they got podcasts. There's power in the assembly of believers. Okay, we need to encourage one another, but watch what he says here. For if we go on sinning willfully, like I'm just not giving this one up, God, after receiving the knowledge of truth, there is no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a terrifying expectation of judgment. What he's saying is, if God has called you and you say, I'm not going, guess what? You're going to be judged just like the world's judged. That's what he's saying here. Judgment, plagues. Boy, this is a depressing sermon, isn't it? Can we go back to that Job thing? That was a lot lighter than this, Pastor. I don't know. But it's all throughout the Bible. I'm just telling you, in Corinthians, and we're getting ready in a few weeks, we're going to take communion together. Watch this verse. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner. He's talking about communion, but again, don't get caught up on the act of communion. Communion is basically us saying, I am in Jesus and Jesus is in me. You know, so what he's talking about now is if we go and we proclaim that and we're not real, we're faking it. Watch what he says. If you do that, you'll be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. In other words, you're making a mockery of Jesus' sacrifice. Don't think he doesn't see that. A man has to examine himself in so doing. He is to eat the bread and drink of the cup. So in other words, you know, before we say we're part of the communion, part of the body of Christ, we need to examine ourselves. And the communion is a public declaration, but we have that in our hearts before then. And he says this, if you eat and drink and you're not worthy, you will eat and drink judgment to himself. Now look at this. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep. That's die, by the way. That's a fancy way of saying a number have died. He's saying, here's why a lot of you are weak and sick and dying when you shouldn't be, is because you're mocking Jesus. You're saying you're saved, but you're not. You're not coming out. You're not being set apart. You're no different than the world. You're just giving it lip service. And that's the problem, he says. And that's what's happening. Knowing and doing nothing is worse than never knowing. And I hate to tell you that because you all know. You know, we have that. God sanctifies us, but first he calls us. And we all love to be sanctified. Oh, I'm redeemed, and all this is good. And God's there to redeem us. But first he calls us out, and then he sanctifies us. That's the way it works. And that's the way it worked in the days of Pharaoh, too. I don't know if you caught on this, but this is just two verses from Exodus. But the night that Pharaoh sends them out is in Exodus 12. They're still in Egypt. He says, get out of here. And that's after the final plague. Get out of here. I can't take you guys anymore. Get out of here. And they actually paid them to leave. They gave them gold and silver and sent them on their way. Right? That's Exodus chapter 12. And in Exodus chapter 13 in our Bibles, we see that they camp at the desert. And then that day, the Lord goes ahead of them in a pillar of cloud. So God's presence comes to them and begins to guide them after they leave Egypt. I want you to catch that. He sanctifies them and his presence joins them after they leave Egypt. He's calling you and you need to leave. And then he sanctifies you. Then he joins you. Then his presence comes alongside of you. Then he guides your steps. We want him to do that before we leave. God says, I need you to come out. I need you to come out. God's presence after we come out. The good news is, this is not difficult. Some of you, I mean, I don't know about that. It seems difficult. No, it's not difficult. It's impossible. Man, I'm just on fire today, huh? What a great sermon. It's impossible. But here's why that's good news. Because God calls you to it, and it's impossible, so that's why he's going to intervene. In a journey of 1,000 steps, he's going to take 999, but you have to take number one. This is what he's waiting for. He's waiting to swoop in and do this. But he needs you to take one step his way. And then he swoops in. But he's waiting for that one step. Let me put it this way. Today, when you woke up, it was a new day for you, but not for God. He had already written your name on his planner. And he's calling you. He's waiting for you to take that one step so he can swoop in. Once he does, it becomes heaven's job. And that's the greatest part about it. Thessalonians says this, may the God of peace himself sanctify you entirely. May your spirit and soul and body be preserved complete without blame at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Faithful is he who calls you. He will bring it to pass. In Philippians, he says this, I am confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perfect it until the day he returns again. I'm confident, he says. He began it and he'll finish it. Don't worry about it. He's not going to stop. He's going to do that. Absolutely. Peter puts it this way. I love Peter. You are a chosen race. You're chosen. A royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light. That's who you are. You're not someone stuck in bondage. You're not stuck in a dead-end job. You're not stuck with friends who don't get it. You're not stuck, you know, running around with like a chicken without its head on and that's going to come to your life. That's not who you are. You're a holy nation. You're special to God. He's called you apart from all that. But we need to make a step towards him in order to make that happen. The God who is calling you is the God who will help you to succeed. One step, his direction. He says this in Revelation, because you're important to him. You understand how important you are to him? He has set this whole thing up for you personally. He loves you and he's calling you right now to come to him. He says this in Revelation, he who sits on the throne, that's God, turns to John. You know, he says, behold, I make all things new. Yeah, you might think you're a loser, but I remake losers into winners all the time. He says, this is what I do. I take people who aren't very good and I make them amazing. Read the Bible. Check out Abraham sometime. What a loser. But he took one step to God and God made him the king of the beginning of the nation of Israel. And God says, this is what I do. Hey, did you see Peter before I got a hold of him? You know, now look at him, right? He says, this is what I do. When I start with you, I will not stop you. I will make you new. You'll be the best you've ever been once I get my hands on you because this is what I do. I make all things new. And then he turns to John and he says this, write that down. For these words are faithful and they're true. This is what God will do once you make that one step toward him. Would you all please pray with me?